When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's Bigfoot Collectors Club with Bryce and Michael. I know a ghost story or two. Let's do this.
It's real.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent many days with the girls, talked with them. It's fucking amazing, man.
That's incredible.
There's so much more to that story than has been told.
So that was just my story of high strangeness that we did last week. And
powerful story. And it's real and it's true. And John Mack went there and talked with them. But talking with the girls is what gets you, because they were one of the girls, Lisa, was in such close proximity.
That's insane.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bigfoot Collectors Club, episode 40, actually. This is the podcast where amazing guests share their personal paranormal history, and we tell tales of high strangeness. I'm your host, Michael McMillan. Always with me is your other host,
Bryce Johnson,
and our trusty producer,
Riley Bray.
And you just heard moments ago, coming in at the top of the show, that was our guest today. He is a filmmaker who has a new film called Hunt for the Skinwalker that is available starting today on demand, multiple platforms. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jeremy Corbell.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Dude,
hey,
what
so
a
you
pleasure.
Guys were just chatting about last week's topic of high strangeness, the aerial school phenomenon. Jeremy, you interviewed some of the women about this?
Yeah, and I got to actually just hang out, you know, with Lisa and Salma. It was a weekend I did up in Oregon, and they were also guests there. And I got, first time I actually got to talk with two of the witnesses who were children at the time.
Wow.
And yeah, it's incredible. It really is what they experienced and how it impacted their lives. If people are skeptical about that case, it's simply because they don't know the facts. It happened. There were so many children that saw it, and it impacted people's lives, and it's an incredible mass sighting.
Wow.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, John Mack, the Harvard psychiatrist who went down there, who was actually in Africa at the time interviewing some famous South African abductees. And then they're like, called him like, hey, get over here to Zimbabwe. We've got another thing for you. And so it was kind of like apropos that he was there at the time, but it became... After him interviewing a lot of those school children, he found it to be, out of all of his research, he said, you know, this is probably one of the most important stories I've ever come across within like the last decade, you know. So he felt tremendous import of what was happening there at that school, you know. And it's just an incredible story.
So, Jeremy, were you there as an investigative filmmaker?
Wherever I go, I guess I have a cell phone with me at all times. I can film stuff. I was there as a guest to talk about some of my work, but it just so happened it was at the McMinimins UFO Festival, which is just – they have a UFO parade. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in a UFO parade.
No.
First time I was.
It
was
I would
crazy.
Like to be.
Oh, my gosh. It was awkward. But anyway, really fun event, and so that's why they were there. And, yeah, just got to spend time with them and the girls, what they experienced. It was incredible. And, yeah, John Mack did study it and look into it. And there is a film coming out about it by a buddy of mine. So look out for that.
I think we posted the link to that in the show notes last week.
Yeah, he's still trying to finish it up, the finishing pieces and stuff. But he's taking his time to do it just right.
There we go. He's been working on it a long time.
So just to clue in our listeners, like, this is going to be a very fun, paranormal-heavy show today. I'm super excited about it. We're going to be revisiting one of our earliest topics we've ever talked about on the show, Skinwalker Ranch. Jeremy just did an entire investigative documentary on the subject with George Knapp, who's sort of the leading expert and wrote the original book on the topic, literally The Hunt for the Skinwalker, which the film's named after. But you also had a film that came out, I believe, earlier this year or last year called Patient 17, which I know Bryce has seen and raved about. I've seen clips from it. Haven't been able to sit down and watch it yet. I apologize, but I will be getting on that after, especially after watching Skinwalker last night, which I thought the film was really, really good. Tell us about what you do as an investigative filmmaker.
Sure. I mean, I'm a self-proclaimed investigative filmmaker. I'm not sure really what that means.
I think it sounds great.
I look into, you know, things that I'm
investigative podcasters. we're investigative bullshitters.
Yeah. I mean, look, anything that, you know, really gets into my brain and I can't let it go. I realized a long time ago that a camera is like a passport into people's lives. There's so much that will be revealed that simply asking people questions, they won't reveal it. So I learned that, you know, a long time ago. I didn't mean to start making films. I can't believe that I'm being successful at making films. There was no, you know, it was something I was just doing for myself. I was a mixed martial arts athlete. That's all I ever did since 9 years old on. I taught at a university for 10 years, had schools all over the country and beyond, and trained. And I got an illness. I could no longer do any of that physically. And it was a very hard identity shift because we identify with the things that we do, but obviously that's a manifestation of who we are. It's not who we are.
Wow, right. Totally.
So I learned that, you know, physically, the hard way, couldn't train and all that, started making artwork. All of a sudden that started taking off for me with this show about Sharon Tate, because I worked with her sister to do this whole show on her style, and it's a whole thing that happened. Anyway, that happened. And there's a documentary crew, and they were following my transition from being a martial artist to a fine artist, which was so weird because I was faking it. It was not at all. Somebody mistook me as a photographer because I was hanging out with this like other real known photographer, and that's how I got my first art gig. It was a joke to me. I mean, it was crazy, but I took it. I'm like, let's do it. And then I realized what they were doing, this documentary crew, it was so much cooler than what I was doing. And I was like, I want to learn that.
Wow.
So amazing. Then, you know, just grabbed a camera, started asking the questions I've always wanted to ask people, realized the camera is powerful, and hopefully I'm have some talent in my ability to do it and make good, compelling visual films, and that's how I started. So, yeah, my first film that really hit was, you know, for years and years and years, I just wouldn't sell out. I wouldn't sell the film to anybody. They wanted to change it. Can't change a frame. That was my only thing.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought I'd really ever get the movie out. All of a sudden, it's on Netflix. So, you know, from there, I got to make a second one. And you know,
what was the first film?
Incredible.
Which was Patient 17? Patient 17 was the first full one
that got hit. Yeah, exactly.
Got
that
it.
Hit mass. I made a bunch of shorts and I got a lot of footage.
I've perused your website, Extraordinary Beliefs, many of time, and there are some incredible. I think you're just your visual storytelling, as well as like, you know, is so. Is so spot on, and it brings like a much needed panache to this whole field. You know, I think so many times people do these, you know, docs or tell these, you know, stories of high strangeness, and they're, you know, it's just missing like a level of what I not professionalism, but a level of high quality. And I remember, you know, when we did this podcast, I was always interested in Roger Lear's work, and then when Patient 17 showed up on iTunes, I was like, oh, I got to see this. And it really just blew me away. And I'm so glad that you got a chance to continue this work and, you know, coming out with Hunt for Skinwalker, which releases today. We all watched it last night.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking the same thing, like what jumping on what you were saying when we were watching last night, because so many of the paranormal films, they kind of tend to drag, and they like, they just feel like they don't, the level of the film doesn't match the level of the story, but like I really dug in yours, like your sound design is awesome, like all the treatment on the voices and stuff with the reverbs and everything, and
sure.
The score is really cool. Like there's a lot of like great music in the film, and it's just the way you weave the visuals and everything, it's just like it's a really nicely put together thing where it gives you that sense of this kind of like dreamy ethereal thing, and it puts your head in the space of that. So I really think you nailed it on that, man.
Thanks, man. I'm really stoked to hear. I mean, you know, I really haven't had any feedback on it. It's really good to hear that you guys appreciated the things that I, you know, care about. So the audio design and the visual aesthetic. I had one simple goal with starting to make films, and that is to raise the visual aesthetic in this field, because I was so disappointed with, you know, how, and I don't even really know what I'm doing.
Mission complete.
That was the mission.
Yeah. Join the club. We have no clue. Well,
so that was the mission, and if I achieved it. And then the audio design, there's this great audio designer out of Pioneer Town or Joshua Tree area, and I worked with him intimately to audio design everything. I was like, okay, I need this sound, a little more violet, you know, and he was really great. His name, Red, Blue, Black, Silver is what he goes by.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mystery that's man. Their man for the job right
Yeah, for sure. Hired.
Yeah.
Ambient synesthesia, I got you covered.
Yep. And I guess the other important thing about my films is that there is absolutely no reason to sensationalize fucking anything.
It's already there.
What's actually true and provable, and what has happened, there's absolutely no reason to change that. Mm-hmm. So by treating it that way, as, you know, documentary, straightforward, mm-hmm. I think we're going to reach more people to what I like to say, weaponize their curiosity, which is not just like a joke. What that means is stop just being a consumer and a viewer of this material, and become an active participant in learning more and getting information out, like having a podcast. Mm-hmm. We need everybody kind of working on this. You know, we all do it differently.
It's true. You know, it's what befuddles me is sometimes we'll run into a guest like we had one just a week ago, like Ben Blacker. He's like, the guy literally sees a ghost in his hallway, and it's confirmed by his wife. She's like, I saw a ghost too. And then they're just like, huh. And then they move on about their daily lives. And I go, how does that work? How does that not like...
Not only move on, but do you believe in ghosts? No, not really. I believe in my ghost.
Right, totally. But, you know, for a guy like me who's, you know, seen and experienced some stuff, it's like, how does that not like crack open the mind? And
yeah,
and
it just... it's like seeing a ghost is like job quitting level for me. Like, it's
seriously.
Like, I have a new calling now.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's, you know, I think it's all tied into the really important questions that I'm always, you know, telling my kids to ask, and that I am always asking is like, you know, who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? You know, and I think all these things that we're always so interested in talking about are directly correlated to those questions.
Well, and we are... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, isn't that interesting, though? We have this consensus reality that we all buy into. We get our Starbucks. We put up recording equipment together. We do podcasts. Mm-hmm. Yet there's something else going on. And when we're confronted with it, depending on how we are personally, or, for example, December 2017, through the New York Times, it was admitted that the United States government is studying UFOs because they're invading our airspace with impunity at all times, and high, credible, ranking military witnesses that are trained observers see these things
and
report them, yet the world doesn't really...
It fell on deaf ears.
Kind
of. I couldn't believe there wasn't more of a reaction to that.
Well, I also think, too, it's just part of the curse of the news cycle that we are currently living in right now. We have somebody who... is pulling a lot of focus, who's in charge of things right now. So I think, you know, when we're living, we're every day there's a new thing and a new headline, and it's immediately forgotten. This sort of slipped under the radar. But I do think over time, this will have a longer shelf life.
I totally agree.
Coming back to it. I mean, it was big for us. It's obviously big for you. I mean, you've opened, and we're going to talk about the film a little bit later in the podcast and really get into it. But you, I think, almost opened the film with a discussion with George Knapp about that. And that was weeks before that news broke. So I think for those of us who are into this, we'll be talking about it for some time to come.
Definitely.
And I want to get into more about Jeremy and more about the movie. But first, I have some Riley facing news. This one was sent to me literally on the way over to the studio today from friend of the show, Jen Kirkman. Shout out, Jen.
Hey, Jen.
This one is from News Out of London. And this was on Sky, and this is, I'm quoting from the Evening Standard. Scientists discovered dozens of signals from alien galaxy 3 billion light years away. 72, I believe. Scientists searching for extraterrestrial life in the universe say they have discovered 72 signals from an alien galaxy using artificial intelligence. Researchers at the SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, examined 400 terabytes of radio data from a dwarf galaxy 3 billion light years away from Earth. They found dozens of fast radio bursts, FRBs, that had previously been missed. FRBs are high-energy pulses and are among the most mysterious phenomena in the cosmos. They are extremely powerful, generating as much energy as hundreds of millions of suns. They were first discovered in 2007, and their exact origin and cause are unknown, and only last a few milliseconds. Scientists enlisted artificial intelligence and machine learning technology to hunt for these signals within existing data. The nature of the object emitting them is unknown, SETI said. There were many theories, including that they could be the signatures of technology developed by extraterrestrial intelligent life. PhD student Gary Zhang of the University of California, Berkeley, developed the machine learning algorithm used to examine the 400 terabytes of data. SETI's Dr. Andrew Simeon said, "Jerry's work is exciting not just because it helps us understand the dynamic behavior of FRBs in more detail, but also because of the promise it shows for using machine learning to detect signals missed by classical algorithms." Scientists have named the source of the newly discovered signals, which are located way outside the Milky Way galaxy, as Repeater FRB 121102.
That's the name of my new band.
Sounds like a robot in Star Wars.
I love it when SETI comes back in the news. You know, oh, I think people brush it off, and it's not as look, this isn't as exciting as some of the stuff we're going to get into today. But it's I love knowing that it's still out there and they are still searching and we're picking up brand new signals now.
My mind just goes to they must have needed a new round of funding.
Come on.
So, I mean, they're using radio telescopes.
Right, sure.
To look for signals from outer space. You know, Terrence McKenna once said it best. He's like, you know, where they built the largest radio telescope in Puerto Rico, and he's like, it was around a cow pasture. And in that cow pasture, in the dung, came all these you know, mushrooms that are able to cause hallucinogenic. So he's like, meanwhile, they're looking for, you know, signals from aliens from outer space. Meanwhile, it's literally right under their telescope. And I always found that such like a...
Yeah, but also, yes, there's inherent irony there. But also, isn't that kind of fucking awesome that the place where we do literally, with the technology that we have then now, build a ear and an eye to talk to higher intelligence is sort of in the nest of where maybe that originally began. There's some beautiful, there's a nice.
No, it's cool. It's cool.
Harmony just, there.
Yeah, it's the intuitive and the scientific.
Yeah.
I just think that the technology that they're trying to use is somewhat outdated. I mean, you know, we did that whole...
They're using robots, artificial intelligence.
Yeah, but they're using radio.
Well, not robots specifically.
They're searching for, you know, they're searching with radio telescopes.
Yeah.
But anyway, because we did that whole story on the Arecibo message and the Chilbolton response, and in that crop circle that came back from the Chilbolton response, there was that enigmatic design that was not a radio telescope but a microwave telescope, maybe just giving some clues as to like, hey, you know, you guys are, you know, looking with the wrong stuff here, you know,
in the wrong frequency spectrum. Right.
Yeah, in the wrong frequency or whatever, but. Look, anyway, it's an interesting story.
I think look everywhere any way you can.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I obviously believe that a lot of this phenomenon comes interdimensionally. I think there's a lot that has to do with psychic connections, consciousness, all that stuff. But I still think that there's got to be...
The occasional radio burst is pretty sweet, too.
Well, look, yeah. And look, there's got to be life on other planets as well. You know what I mean? So let's look everywhere, within, without, everywhere.
Totally.
Yeah, there's that old quote, you know, truth is perceived in fragments and from different angles of vision. I think Gandhi said that. But the point of that is that it takes all sorts of ways of looking at something to discover the truth, both outward looking and inward looking. And sometimes when we're looking for one thing, like you'll see with a lot of the things we've learned through NASA experiments, we learn something else and we gain in another way. But I agree with you. It's a fascinating time, and all of these technologies I think are important, from the magic mushroom all the way up to the radio telescope.
Yeah, totally. Right on. Well, there you go.
All right. So, Jeremy, we ask this to all of our guests. You've obviously arrived at a place in your life where you are making films about these topics. But what is your personal paranormal history?
Oh, gosh. I'm like the Inspector Crusoe. Like, I miss everything, dude. Everybody else sees shit and I report on it. That's basically my personal history.
Well, how did you get into this stuff? I mean, was there anything as a kid that, like, a book or something that captured your imagination?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, no, I understand the question more now. I usually fail the first time I ask the question, so I'll go here in a second.
It's a blanket question, and then we work our way through it.
Here we go. So actually, how I got interested at all, the first thing that I do like to say, like, weaponized my imagination or my curiosity, it really set me on this path. I couldn't shake it. It was hearing Bob Lazar on the radio when I was 13 years old. That was 1989. He went on the radio with my now mentor in journalism, George Knapp, who's an incredible journalist.
And was George, was this during, was he hosting Coast to Coast at the time?
So he was reporting on Bob Lazar through KLAS News, right?
Okay,
he broke the story of Area 51, and he broke the story of Bob Lazar claiming that he was part of the reverse engineering program just south of Area 51. So those audio bits kind of made their way around the globe. And as a kid, I heard it on the radio. And what was so powerful, what turned me on, was that this concept he described. So look, we all have gotten to the point where there's probably intelligent life in the universe everywhere. Big question, are they visiting here? Now, we've come to that consensus that, you know, in general, there probably is intelligent life. But back then, when you brought that up, I mean, that was not the way people treated it. It was not something that we all agreed upon. People would, you're crazy, UFOs. We're now at a point saying, not only do we know that life is everywhere throughout the universe, it's probably homogenous, but it is actually possible they could visit here. But the moment that really flipped me was when Bob described the propulsion system. That's how it started for you. I'm a very nuts and bolts guy, even to this day. He described a system of traveling through time-space that did not require faster-than-light travel. It is about gravity amplification through a high-powered source of what's called element 115. And by using this type of gravity wave amplification system, you're literally falling towards your target.
Yeah.
It is a non-reactionary propulsion system. So it's not a push-pull, something out the back, go forward. Totally different. So that concept, it blew my mind. It flipped my script. You're falling towards a target. It made me realize that this is not impossible. And so that's what made me start looking into these topics.
And wasn't element 115, that was something that hadn't been on the periodic table yet? And then later scientists discovered, and I forget the full name for it, it's something very hard to pronounce.
Muscovium, unimpentium.
Unimpentium,
yeah,
that's what it is.
I like calling it Lazarium, but yeah.
Right.
Also, shameless plug, it's that's an inspiration for a device that comes along in Adventure Van.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, my new comic book out in stores.
Inspired
now.
As well by the Bob Lazar.
But I love that story about element 115, and then he described something that hadn't been on the... I'm paraphrasing this and remembering it, and perhaps misremembering it, but then later they discovered it and added it to the periodic table.
Well, it is a big deal. Bob actually thinks it's less of a big deal than I do, but it is a big deal. But, you know, just to be clear, so it is a super heavy element that we suspected, you know, would exist somewhere in the universe, would have been fabricated through, you know, a different supernova with more matter or something. It's something we knew could exist, probably did exist, but we just had never fabricated it in a laboratory. So we always kind of knew, science knew that it could exist. So Bob, you know, saying 115, it was a suspected element. Mm-hmm. However, the interesting part is after Bob describes its properties and this sort of thing, it was fabricated twice here on Earth.
Amazing.
But it's like we're like chimpanzees throwing crap on a wall.
Yeah.
We're trying to bombard, you know, a nucleus and try to create element 115, and, you know, had a half-life of, you know, less milliseconds. So it's not the stable version that Lazar talked about. But with the right isotopes, it could be stable. And people say that's pseudoscience. That's a big thing people got against Lazar's story. No. I have talked with some of the top scientists in the fucking world, and I did this for the film, who deal with super heavy elements, and across the board, they say you cannot rule out a super heavy element, like specifically 115 being stabilized, yet scientists use this to poke holes because they don't want to believe the Bob Lazar story. It's fucked up.
That is crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, there is a huge possibility of a stabilized element 115, not naturally occurring here on Earth, not something we can make in any large amount, but it's something that could be harvested. Can't rule it out. Fucking science.
Wow.
I think I just heard Bryce's boner growing.
It did. I totally got the science boner is up and on. You know, I forget where I originally saw it, but I remember somebody describing in a visual how gravitational propulsion works. And imagine like a mattress and then a bowling ball on that mattress. Now, if you push your hand anywhere around that bowling ball is going to fall towards that gravity hole. And, you know, in essence, you know, that's kind of how gravity propulsion works in essence. Am I right? I mean,
yeah. So there's two really great visuals for it. And the one you're saying is the one Bob likes to say. But let's look at it real simply. So like any wave, like a microwave, you can amplify a wave. You have a wave. So what we know about gravity, it's so interesting. And by the way, Bob also said gravity was a wave.
Yeah.
At the time, people thought, oh, it's probably graviton.
Right. And now we know that to be true.
Yeah, it's a wave.
Incredible.
Yeah. So if you got a wave and you can harness it somehow and you can amplify that wave, then like you're saying, we know the gravity is intimately related with time and space. That's why atomic clocks that are put up, and we have to adjust our satellites to it, because the farther it is away from Earth, you know, time slows down in our version of it. So that's something that Einstein talked about, and we actually literally have to calculate, you know, our clocks, you know, because of gravity. So this is a real effect. So if you can amplify a gravity wave and direct it, then all of a sudden, you've got that bowling ball effect where it's like as if you put bowling ball on a mattress and you're falling towards that source.
Incredible.
But additionally, the idea is, I'll have to use my shirt to show you.
He's taking his shirt off.
Yeah. If I amplify and I pull space towards me like that, and then when I turn it off, boom, I end up being there. That makes sense. You can't see my shirt.
That's the wrinkle in time method with the ant walking across. The ant, I think this is wrinkle in time.
Yeah.
There's an ant on one edge of the paper, and he's trying to get to the other side. Instead of crawling across it, you roll up the paper and then roll it back. The ant goes over where the two ends cross, and then you bring it back.
He does this so much better than us.
I know.
Do you want to host this podcast?
I just tried to mansplain what you did.
No, it sounds about right. There's another one where they take a dollar bill, they poke a pencil through it, and the idea is like a wormhole. And it's similar to that, but it's more about elasticity. Mm. Time and space, we know, is more like a fabric. That's why I was using my shirt.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point is, if you can amplify a gravity wave, and we know gravity is a wave, and you can fucking amplify any wave if you learn how to do it, but it's generating gravity. Nobody can do that. The moment we can generate gravity, everything becomes possible in science fiction you ever heard about. That is the key.
Well, and on just sort of what we're into here, that what you're describing would then explain why when people see these crafts hovering in space and then shoot off into the sky or just zip or even disappear, that would explain why they're able to do some of these crafts are able to do some of the visual tricks that they do, basically.
It's about to get fucking weird. Ready?
Let's do it.
So, Commander David Fravor.
Wait, do you need to take off your pants for this?
Now that we're
comfortable with one another,
you know, I'm known for this. That's why I don't do visual podcasts. My wife hates that. So, when so Commander David Fravor, when he saw the Tic Tac UFO reported by the New York Times, the way he described it to me personally, and I did break that story before, and there's audio out there, and you know, it is a great story, man. I was on it for years. I got a tip off, you know, from some government individuals that allowed me to find Commander Fravor.
That's wild.
It was one of the coolest moments for me. So anyway, here's the deal. He's talking about the Tic Tac UFO moving kind of like a ping pong ball in a glass, bah, 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 against the edges.
Mm.
Now here's the deal. Is it moving like that because of the way it's distorting gravity, or are we off? Is that the optical nature of something that is distorting time space?
Right.
So we don't really know if it's optical. See what I'm saying? If it's optical nature, or but the point is this: by the nature of it itself, if something is gravity propelled, which everybody is sure this craft we're talking about was, because the signatures you'd see, like you're talking about those deep space signatures of every kind of propulsion has a type of signature. It is believed this is gravity propelled, the Tic Tac, the one that he saw. So they can create and utilize gravity to move through time space. So the pilot is seeing it one way, or by nature, they are time travelers, because when you distort time space, you're distorting time. So it's just, it's kind of funny. Are these extraterrestrials, extra dimensionals, extra temporals? It's all freaking the same.
Wow.
You know, and that's the kind of interesting thing. We don't have the tools to know. We just know that there is an intelligence engaging humanity from the beginning of recorded human history, that its technology appears to be beyond ours. But the only thing we truly know about UFOs is they represent a huge amount of power in a small amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, we don't know. It comes from witness testimony, and it appears these intelligences are kind of fucking with us.
Yeah.
Telling us a narrative that may or may not be true.
Well, and it's so hard to describe what you see or describe what you've encountered when we have such a limited vocabulary and perspective on these things, you know.
We don't have enough filters.
We're limited. We're completely limited. We always go back to the analogy to bring ants back up again, but it'd be like an ant trying to describe a human being, you know. From their perspective, they see giants, and they might see is the bottom of a Nike over their head, you know what I mean? So they're just describing the sole of a tennis shoe, in this analogy, and they don't see the human form that is attached, you know, the foot that's in that shoe that's above their head. They don't have the perspective or the vocabulary to describe that encounter.
Yeah,
they're just like, there's giant things that come out of the sky and squish us. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's all they know.
Alexander the Great, both sides of the war, there was just one battle. They talked about shields on fire.
Yeah.
Silver shields on fire. Shields, that's what they knew. Mm-hmm. It was airships in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Bob Lazar gives this great analogy. He says, when we were working on this reactor, he goes, think about it. What if you went back to like the Wild West times and you gave them a nuclear reactor? Well, they're going to crack it open. The second they crack it open, that core, they're not going to know what happened. They're all going to die. Mm. Everybody that comes in to check on the dead people, they're all going to die. It will look like magic to them because they don't have the technology or understanding of a nuclear reactor. Same thing for us looking at this. We're not seeing what it is.
Technology is indistinguishable from magic.
There we go.
Technology.
Ain't that true? Amen.
You know, and it was Jacques Vallée who kind of, through his research and everything, came to that what I think is a pretty like undeniable conclusion that when, you know, that back in time, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, people were seeing dirigibles, like, you know, floating like balloon ships. And then today, and the phenomena sort of progresses as we progress as a culture and a society, and it changes along with us. It morphs. And so it really, like, I mean, it got him off the extraterrestrial hypothesis into what he kind of developed as the IDH, is what's known as the interdimensional hypothesis. And he took a lot of shit for it. And I think as more ufologists are, like, you know, coming across these undeniable tales of like high strangeness, they can't but help to wonder, you know, maybe I should move my prognosis and theories more towards that interdimensional aspect of it, because it almost becomes undeniable, you know.
Because you just went so deep right there, I just want to tell you, you'll appreciate this story. So, you know, Jacques Vallée, obviously, you know, a hero in this field, cagey individual. I have developed a friendship with him over some time. He ended up coming out to my ranch in Pioneertown.
Wow.
It was this great moment where, you know, finally we're comparing notes on some physical analysis material that I did a movie on, Patient 17, and he's working on 17 different samples himself. So we're looking at my notes, comparing notes, talking. I'm like, this is it, man. This is my chance. We sit down. Sun's coming down on my ranch. Beautiful Josh trees everywhere. And I turn to him. I go, you know, Jacques, man, you've been doing this. I mean, even for the United States government, for Project Blue Book, the first ever computerized system tracking UFOs. I mean,
this guy's a legend.
Man, you're the godfather.
Seriously. So I'm like,
I got to ask you, man, you know, what the fuck is going on? What is this all about?
Yeah.
And he takes this like overly long pause, you know, and he's just like looking, and he turns to me and goes, well, damned if I know.
Yeah.
But at least you're asking the questions it took me decades to ask.
Amen.
And I was like, that's not an answer, man. I was like, so, you know, it killed me. So yeah. Even after all these years of studying, you know, this godfather of ufology, this yep. guy, you know, he still doesn't know the true nature of this phenomenon.
But doesn't that just reek of the truth? He's not going to put out some bullshit theory. And, you know, I've always said what makes this life interesting is having the questions that propel this mystery forward. I've never needed to know the answers. And you know, I've never took the answers at face value. But really, the questions just keep coming up and different questions arise over the more that we learn about this. Having done this podcast now for about a year and researching all these stories, I mean, you just find that it becomes, the phenomenon becomes so strange, you know, and it becomes, and just the way it interacts with the receiver or the individual or the witnesses is a story in and of its own. You know, I've always said that I think the experiencer plays an almost integral part of this relationship that happens between the phenomena and the experiencer. And so if that has something to do with consciousness or there's an interplay there that's sort of pulling us towards that phenomena. I don't know what that is, but I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable truth, you know, and you're right. But I do hope that we get closer to some answers. Like if you have a personal experience, it's hard to deny that. So I do hope that we get somewhere, that we do learn more. But yeah, you know, there is this interaction. The uncomfortable truth is that there is some intimate connection between our consciousness and the way we perceive and the phenomenon itself engaging us.
Well, let me turn that question right back on you, Jeremy. I mean, the same one that you gave to Jacques. What is this all about?
Fuck if I know, man. Yeah. Look, what I do know is that it is not as simple as just other beings from other star systems interested in Earth. However, that could be an element of what we're seeing. Mm. That there is something much deeper, much more uncomfortable that, you know, to wrap our minds around that is happening. And Skinwalker Ranch taught me that, because it's one thing to hear a ghost story.
Yeah.
I mean, I really haven't seen very much of anything myself, but it's one thing, I'd imagine that would be compelling, but it's one thing to hear a story, and it's another thing to witness a private scientific study over a duration of 7+ years, see a journalist that worked on that, George Knapp, on that story for 20 years, and then to see a government study come in funded by the United States military. And that's, by the way, that's what my movie breaks. That's a story my movie breaks. People don't know the truth yet.
Yeah.
They're gonna, especially if they watch the bonus materials. That $22 million we talked about in December of 2017 that was admitted wasn't for ATIP. You know, it wasn't for that program, that UFO-based program, that reactionary UFO-based program. It was for the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
The ranch is the reason that $22 million ever came through the Pentagon through Harry Reid. People don't know that yet, and they're going to learn that history, and that's important.
And we'll talk more about that. I feel like the film did imply that. I mean, I picked up a bit on it. I was like, oh, that makes sense, especially since Robert Bigelow was involved heavily in both. But before we do, I just want to ask you, so how did you go, Jeremy, from being a kid, listening to George Knapp interview Bob Lazar, to MMA fighter, and now sitting down with people like Jacques Vallée, sitting down with George himself, going to Skinwalker Ranch, meeting with John. Did you meet with John Lear during Patient 17?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. With John Lear, I filmed. Roger Lear, I met with. John Lear's another dude. Yeah.
I'm thinking of Johnny Mac. Sorry. Anyway, I don't have the encyclopedic.
No, but I get the
name. Name memorization that Bryce does. But how did you get to work? How did you go from that to this? What, you know, if you can nutshell, like, how did you get into all this?
I think another way of what Michael's putting it is you've embedded yourself and with some of the most highly respectable people within this entire field, and what an honor that must be. And you know, yeah, and just to get back on his question, how did you manage to befriend these people and gain their trust and you know hang out with them is even cooler. You know what I mean?
Like, they're asking for a friend.
I just want to know, how did you go from being that kid to being a filmmaker in this field?
Clearly, my charming personality.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, I mean, I know that at one point you were at an art show mistaken for a photographer, but from that point, how did you get from there to here?
I mean, you know, so extreme, you know, I could say the CIA embedded me, and there we go, and everybody will question me. No, that's some of the guys thought, like, I got to be a military plant. No, I just was persistent. I guess I am a persistent person, but I'm not an asshole, you know? Yeah. Your integrity and who you are, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. Like, you know, I'm truly curious and interested. I want to move the needle forward. And I think people, when they get to certain phases in their life, they can see that. They, you know, they got good bullshit meters. They can see if you want to take something or you want to contribute something. Mm. And I certainly want to contribute something. So these friendships that have gone on in my life, I think they're just durational. They're because I'm sincere, I'm interested, yeah. and I want to make something. I want to put something
but,
out.
Well, and why? But why make this? Okay. Was there a moment when you went, I could do something about the Rocky Mountains, but instead I'm going to do something about alien abductions? What was it that pulled you in the direction of this field? That's what I want to know.
God, I don't have a great answer for that. I have never really thought about it. I have been asked that recently, actually, and I didn't know what to say then. I think I didn't have a concept of myself outside of the martial arts. That was my identity. Everything, live, die, breathe, that's all I'm ever going to do. And that was stupid of me. You know, I misunderstood what that we are not what we do. So I think what happened is when I got the ability to start asking people questions about the things I'm most interested in and started getting answers, it's like an addiction. You're like, oh, okay, if that's true, then what about this? And hey, if I can contact that guy and end up, you know, learning from him, well, what about this guy? So I think it's just that, you know, people say like the rabbit hole, but it's more like a Bruce Lee movie. You know, you conquer one level, you go to the next. Where can I get next? Where can I learn more? You know, that's kind of how I'm seeing it. And I do got to say that George Knapp has been a great entity in my life. You know, we've developed a trust and a journalistic relationship. You know, he'll point me in directions, tell me if I'm wasting time. So that has been really, you know, it's good to have a mentor in any craft that you do. If you have somebody you respect, you look up to, and they can tell you when you're fucking wrong or you're off before you go spin your wheels too much, that's valuable. So I think it's just, man, I'm interested in this. Isn't this the biggest question? I mean, I can tell you guys, are you have a show of that? This is the biggest question.
Absolutely.
Right here. Are we alone in the universe? Not only are we alone, have we been visited? You know, visited by who? What's the agenda? What's the nature of reality? Why are we here?
Well, without a doubt. And it all comes back to me is truth seeking. Like, you know, whether it's religion or spirituality or dogma the abduction phenomena or aliens or UFOs or poltergeists or angels and demons, it all comes down. It's all going to end, I think, down the same tunnel as you know, which is, what is this? What defines this? And how does that relate to my life, you know, here on Earth, you know?
Explaining to your kids, you know, some of these.
Well, that's
how do you do that? I don't, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking that today on my way over. It's like, you know, I can't be that dad when my son asked me, hey, are there monsters in the world? I can't be the dad that just goes, oh, no, oh, that's just bullshit. You know, I got to be like, I got to word it carefully. I said, you know, the world is a mysterious place. You know, I don't know what's out there, but, you know, there are things out there.
That makes me think of, there's a line in your film that I loved. I'm going to butcher it, I'm sure, but it was something along the lines of, it's better to examine the unexplained than explain the unexamined.
Mm-hmm. I learned that from George. That's, you know,
I love that.
Investigate the unexplained.
That's it.
Not explain the uninvestigated. Too many times we do that ourselves. We're like, oh, that's what that is. We don't investigate it. So that's an old journalistic term. It's the duty of science and journalism to investigate the unexplained, not explain the uninvestigated.
Yeah. Mm. And so where, even if we don't get to the direct answer, this is this and that's what we're calling it, it's the pursuit of figuring it out and
I've heard it's the journey.
It. Yeah. It's
well, great. Listen, you know, not to speak on you know, George Knapp's not to speak on his behalf, but I'm sure guys like him and Bob Lazar and even John Lear have a wonderful validation with the work that you've brought to the table. Like, I mean, you could almost just, I read that article that that George gave to Shadows of the Mind, and even seeing him on your documentary Hunt for Skinwalker, there's a light in his eyes that that was kind of like a, you know, thank you for bringing these tapes to light. I mean, as he even says in the film, you know, my first intention was never to do a book; it was always to do a documentary. So for someone like yourself to come along and pick up those pieces and help bring that dream and that into reality, into fruition, I'm sure. You know, they appreciate it on a whole level.
Oh, so. I pester the hell out of him, though. I'm like, come on, man, let me in those boxes. Can you imagine? I'm like, the world's not allowed to see these, Jeremy. I'm like, let me in the
right,
box.
Right, right. No, totally. You
know? And then making a film. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like we're all beating around the bush here. Yeah. We really want to get to talking to Hunt for the Skinwalker. But first, this is a tradition. It's become a tradition with all of our guests. Jeremy, we're going to play a little game with you called Bullshit or Believe It.
Oh, I was going to say, this would be great for
this
him.
Is rapid fire. There's no right or wrong answer. I'm just going to go down a list, and you quickly say bullshit if you don't believe in it, or believe it if you think it's true.
Whatever
and, you know
I'm
what,
about
there might
to say is going to be bullshit.
There might be some stuff in between, so, you know. But you only get two answers, bullshit or believe it. Okay?
Okay.
On your mark.
Okay.
Get set. Ghosts.
Pass.
Gotta say one or the other.
You can like believe.
You can
wait,
believe it.
What do you mean by ghost?
It's about what. Just
okay.
That's
it's,
how
it's
I tried
you.
To play.
To,
yeah, I tried this too.
There's more stuff on this list.
Every answer.
Believe it.
Great. UFOs.
Believe it.
Bigfoot.
God, I'm bad at this game.
It's okay. Just go with your instinct. Bigfoot.
The way people think about it. Bullshit.
Great. Angels.
The way people think about it. Bullshit.
Gnomes.
I wish it wasn't bullshit.
JFK assassination conspiracies.
Oh, that's truth.
Fairies.
I'll take it.
Bullshit or believe it. Those
believe
are your
it.
Answers. Unicorns.
Bullshit.
Loch Ness Monster.
Bullshit.
Alien Greys.
Believe it.
Parallel universes.
Believe it.
Reptilians disguising themselves as humans.
Utter bullshit.
Mermaids.
Bullshit.
Heaven.
Don't know. fuck. I'll just believe it. No, I don't know.
Hell.
Okay. Hell. Oh, I believe that.
Dragons.
Kimono dragons?
No, sure. dragons.
Believe it.
Yeti.
Believe it. She's my wife.
Elves.
Elves. Believe it.
ESP.
Believe it.
Chupacabra.
Bullshit.
Demons.
Believe it.
Atlantis.
Believe it.
Life on other planets.
Believe it.
World peace.
Believe it.
Peace in the multiverse.
Oh, my.
Well, that's a new one.
Believe it.
I wrote that one just for you.
Awesome.
So you were pretty, you came down pretty hardcore, believe it, on demons.
Oh, yeah, demons. Yeah, just I met some. No, I mean, it all depends what you mean. I mean, some of those things, I have no idea. You
right.
know? But yeah, there seems to be a malevolent force that can. I have been witness to that effect of that from the ranch experience. There are some very negative things that have happened. I don't know what you call them. Like, what is a demon?
Sure.
You know, is that a religious?
That's why this is all open for interpretation anyway.
Right. But just in general, yeah, there is positive and there is negative in this world, and we definitely want to be on one side of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the non-traditional Bigfoot. What's the traditional Bigfoot versus the non-traditional
right,
Bigfoot?
Right, like if you talk with Jane, or what's her name?
Jane Goodall?
Yeah, she absolutely promoted the idea that, you know, the idea of Bigfoot could be very real, but she's talking about some sort of, animal that's been in hiding. Now, I that could be true, and there could also be this other kind of humanoid being. I think from the encounters that I've really heard about that I trust, like from the scientists at Bigfoot at Skinwalker Ranch, that these beings are actually dimensional beings that they appear to come out of portholes. Like
they've been
saying
it for years.
Oh, yeah,
so I would say yes, but I don't think it's just a species that we, like, you know, Jane Goodall is saying. Yeah. I think that this is because a lot of times flying saucers are witnessed around these incidents of people saying what we call Bigfoot. So
yeah.
Bigfoot, as we know it, I'm thinking. They're dimensional beings.
Yeah, I would agree. I often think that the ufology field and the Bigfoot field is very analogous to each other. Like, you know, I would say about 80% of you know, the people who study UFOs and are interested in this stuff are like, oh, this is nuts and bolts. This is craft from high technology from another planet. Whereas in the Bigfoot field, they're like, no, this is just a wood ape that we have undiscovered and has, you know, has evaded our detection. And I'm going, no. You know, because people pick and choose their details of these stories. You know what I mean? They're so quick to like put away like the strangeness of a saucer case that that can't be explained, like a guy going back and taking his camera and filming the same craft that he was investigating a month later, you know, or like a Bigfoot case when the tracks just completely disappear. You know what I mean? They don't want to like take these into consideration. You know, they pick and choose their facts.
Yeah, it's
I
almost,
think puts them in a hole.
It's almost like the phenomenon provides us great opportunity to discredit ourselves.
Yeah,
it's very strange. You'll be happy to know, being a fan of Bigfoot, when a colleague of ours, Dave Politis, he's touching back into that field. Very soon, you're going to hear about.
Oh,
him.
That's Dave great. Politis. That's not a name.
Missing 411 guy. He did a lot of. He did all those books about the missing people in the national parks,
right?
Yet he started, people don't know, with the Bigfoot topic.
Wow.
And he's coming back to it. I think we're going to be hearing about that real soon. Oh, so you're going to love that.
Dude, I'll be in.
But yeah, the idea of what you're saying, which is that the high strangeness. Now, I learned that really the hard way. You hear of a report, a close encounter. People don't tell you what actually happened until they trust you, because it is so strange that they feel like they can tell you they saw a craft or a light in the sky, but there's typically more to it. And when you get those stories out, I mean, it's a brain teaser.
Yeah.
It's almost as if these events, the phenomenon expresses itself in order to confuse, manipulate, and distort, and I don't know. I mean, it's very
strange. To use Vallée's words, theater of the absurd.
Oh, that's a perfect way to explain it.
Yeah. Yep. Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know, man. It's weird.
Well, the sound you just heard is Bryce signing his divorce papers. And when we come back.
Honestly, the look on both of your faces when he started talking about Bigfoot and portals was priceless. Because we're very big on the portal theory.
We'll be right back to talk to Jeremy about his new movie, Hunt for the Skinwalker.
All right. I said last night, should we wait?
It's okay.
Go for it.
I said last night, I was like, maybe that's like a bad Bigfoot. Maybe there's like good Bigfoots and bad Bigfoots, you know, because I know you talked about, you know, the malevolence that was kind of felt on the Skinwalker Ranch. And you know, every coin has its opposite side. And there's so many, even part of the abduction phenomena that has that, you know, my life turned into for the better. And you have these like kind of malevolent stories, but you also have on the other side is these very like kind of like benevolent type experiences where people are like, you know, my life was really out of disarray and I was abducted and it came into total place and I felt peace, love, and harmony. And I got messages of like nuclear disarmament and like world peace. And so there's definitely two sides at play here. And yeah, when he was talking about that creature, which was one of the things I loved of that. Listen, the reason I am fascinated with Skinwalker Ranch is because it throws it all in a cereal bowl and asks you to eat it up. You know what I mean? It's like orbs, giant birds, metallic objects,
dire wolves,
portals, openings in the sky.
That's great. This is a perfect segue to the question I want to ask Jeremy, which is for our listeners. And especially our new listeners who may have not listened to our Skinwalker Ranch episode, which is Bigfoot Collectors Club episode 3 with Mary. Is that with Mary Holland? I think yes. Go back; it's one of the early ones. I believe it's called "We Know the Same Ghost from High School."
Yeah, right. Which is a great story.
Jeremy, just nutshell: what is Skinwalker Ranch? We've talked a lot about it on the show, and I find that it's one of those topics that's a little elusive. You're always sort of looking for the it. You're looking for the that's the Skinwalker in this story. I think your film does a really good job of sort of laying it out there. So for our listeners, what is the Skinwalker Ranch?
Right, yeah. So if it's not on people's radar, once you hear it, you can't get away from it. It's one of the most compelling stories in the world, and that's because of the studies, the scientific studies. It is the most studied scientifically paranormal hotspot in human recorded history. This place has had more government and private industry eyes and scientists looking at this place as a living laboratory than anywhere else that has high activity, everything from UFOs to Bigfoot to dimensional portholes to cattle mutilations to what they call blue meanies, which are these orbs that fly through and invoke an unnatural amount of fear into people's brains. And this has all been scientifically studied and documented, and it's incredible. So it is a 480-plus acre ranch in northeastern Utah that historically, for hundreds of years, if not thousands, have had reported encounters, close encounters, with other entities. The term skinwalker is a Native American term, you know, basically meaning, it's a catch-all term meaning trickster or witch or shapeshifter. But George Knapp and Dr. Colin Kelleher, who literally wrote the book called Hunt for the Skinwalker, used that term in their title because it was a Native American term, and they found that one of the ridges on this ranch they called Skinwalker Ridge because it was what they call the, it's in the path of the skinwalker, mm-hmm. like an animal. There's a place where it comes from, where it goes through. But what's important for your listeners to know is that there is a ranch in northeastern Utah, and it was used as a living laboratory both by Robert Bigelow, who's an aerospace mogul who ended up putting seven scientists or more than that for 7 years on this ranch to study 24 hours a day what he thought was just UFO activity. And he quickly learned is far beyond UFO activity.
But that's not the beginning of the story, is it? It wasn't always a research center, was it?
Right. It was not. It was just a ranch. And interestingly enough, the couple, the family that came, that we call the Gormans, and I will continue to call them even if their name gets out elsewhere for their anonymity. But
I think like in episode 3 of this podcast, maybe.
Oh, whoops.
yeah. No, but like it's out, but just from a journalistic standpoint,
sure.
So we'll call them the Gormans. So that's a family that moved on to the ranch. So just imagine, I mean, they raise, you know,
and this is in the early 90s, 93, 94, I think?
Yeah, it would probably be 95 or something like that. I know Robert Bigelow bought it in 96, so maybe it was 94.
Okay.
Mid-90s.
Something
like that. So they bought this ranch. It was like, it is a dream property. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
A creek that runs through, mountains, everything around. It's perfect. And they were raising Seminole cattle, really high-end cattle. That was what they were doing. And, you know, they signed this deed, and it says some funny things in the deed, like, you know, if you're going to dig up the earth, make sure to notify the owners 2 weeks beforehand. And they just thought they were kind of losing it, these other owners. What are they talking about?
Yeah.
So they kind of move in blind onto this ranch, and they're stoked. They're happy. Within the first 5 minutes of being there, they have their first encounter with the unknown. There's this huge sentient-looking wolf that...
This story's crazy. I mean, we talked about it on the podcast, but it and the way it's told in your film, like, that was one of my favorite moments in the movie.
So let me just, I'll back up 1 second. The cool thing about the film is that no footage was ever allowed off of the ranch in the history of the ranch. George Knapp was allowed to do a book without even a single photograph.
But he took a bunch of photographs bunch of films.
He filmed the entire time. He wanted to make a documentary, and then Mr. Bigelow asked him not to because he owned it at the time, and he didn't want people invading, you know, the ranch, as has happened from the book anyway, because the phenomenon does react to the people and the consciousness, and it's an elusive predator. You have to hunt it like a sentient intelligence, a precognitive sentient intelligence, mm-hmm. like Dr. John Alexander talked about. So without getting too far ahead, my point is what you're seeing in this film was never supposed to be seen, this footage from the active investigations at the ranch. But for your viewers, just to back up, just to give you one first experience.
Well, but before you move on, the thing that I really love about the movie is it really is a blend of your film. It's a film that's your documentary, but then it's edited in are all these original pieces of footage that George took. So it's sort of like
it's an
amalgamation of the original intent of the documentary, and now you coming along and wrapping it up in this nice, beautiful presentation.
Thanks. Yeah, that was a difficult thing in the movie was to, you know, honor the original kind of, we put him into like news reports, you know, because George is such a famous newsman. So you'd get that original footage from the active investigations of like the NIDS team, the scientific team that was there. But then surrounding that with modern day events, because they're so connected, more than people think. And we talked about that, the $22 million actually all came from and was for the ranch through a program, a bigger UFO program that was admitted to the American public. It was called OSAP. So that's one aspect. And then in the film, getting the new interviews with people who have been, you know, 30 years bordering. Because look, the whole Uinta Basin, the whole area has high activity. I mean, I talked with the cops there, the tribal police.
I love this story. Please tell us this story when you talked to the tribal police.
Oh, that
when
was...
you got pulled over.
Right, well, I didn't get pulled over. They they came up to us. But basically, what happened is, I don't have this on film. They didn't want to go on camera, but they were checking our permits because never before had the tribe allowed people to have permits to film and take them off of the reservation. So we had permits. So we get kind of pulled over. They come over to us, and what was so this was the most shocking moment to me, you know, these two, this is the one you're talking about, these police, these officers. So they're kind of checking our stuff. And then one pulls me aside. He's like the big boss. And he pulls me aside and he was truly concerned for me. And he says, look, I've seen it happen before. You are here hunting whatever this is. It knows you're here hunting and it will hunt you back. And I was kind of like, kind of taken aback by that. Like, what is he talking about? I'm kind of looking at him. Meanwhile, he's scrolling through his phone, shows me this badass UFO video that he took this huge UFO over a house that he wouldn't give me the video, but I saw it on his cell phone. I mean, this is not a guy who like fake cell phone footage. It's one,
you should unload that soon.
He says, he said,
before that phone drops
in the
creek.
Maybe he'll give it to me one day. Yeah. So he says, you know, basically we don't go out looking for this stuff here. It happens all around here and it's like a car crash. It's in our face all of a sudden, but we're not hunting it. And that's dangerous to do. And I've seen people get hurt. And I've heard stuff like that. But having him tell me that, not on camera, not to freak me out, but out of true concern. And then to have that look in his eye and he looks at his partner. And it's like his partner kind of gives him the okay. And I look at him. I said, he's talking about you, isn't he? His police partner. I said, what happened? And he says, well, I'm on patrol. It's about 4 years ago. I'm on patrol. And I... sitting there pulled over listening to radio and I look up and there is a huge kind of humanoid wolf creature hunched in the middle of the road looking at me big. And I'm like, fuck, that's scary. Sure, it wasn't like a wolf or a drunk dude or something like that. And he goes, I watched it for 2 minutes in shock, and then I turned on my siren and lights and the thing just stood up, looked at me, and walked into the woods.
Two legs.
On two legs. And so I would say this was like a kind of like a Bigfootish kind of experience, but he described it more like a humanoid wolf. And, you know, this sounds totally nuts to me, right? But if you're hearing this guy tell it, it doesn't want to go on camera. He didn't even know I'd be repeating this story. And I go, how big? How big was this? And he points to his SUV police cruiser.
Wow.
And he goes, a little bigger than that. I mean, it's just terrifying. So whoa. Anyway, what really stuck with me, because that's just a story. But what stuck with me, besides seeing the video of the UFO on his cell phone, was that he had true concern for my well-being. This wasn't a show he was putting on. I come to find out why, and I come to understand it more, knowing people over the years there and that kind of thing. They even had a shaman on deck because they were like, you know, what happened to this guy who saw it? It followed him home. And what I mean by that, not the big creature. And this was the DIA termed them hitchhikers. Mm-hmm. I know, which is weird to say, but that's in... if there are government documents that refer to this stuff, you know, it might refer to it as hitchhiker.
Right.
So a hitchhiker in this area is the idea that once you encounter whatever this is, that there, it's like a virus. It comes and kind of starts to infect your life and often your loved ones. And that's a freaky, scary kind of thing to say. But it happened to multiple DIA agents who were on the ranch during the government study. That has been confirmed. I know the whole story behind it. I've said it a few times. So has George Knapp. So has a couple other people.
Yeah, it was an eerie part of the documentary.
And I always thought when you were driving through the Southwest and picked up a hitchhiker, they were just a meth head.
Typically, that would be.
I would rather have a meth head than the type of
hitchhiker
Jeremy's describing.
But you're talking about negative, malevolent forces that are following people home.
Yeah, what I'm talking about is what you would call, you know, paranormal activity or something like that, a poltergeist-like activity. So to give you a specific example, you know, one of the DIA agents who came home after, or two of them in particular, I mean, they get home and things like things flying off the walls, their family, their wives and children seeing these upright standing, I know it sounds crazy, like kind of wolf men things that are peering at them. Yes, I'm talking about what they call hitchhikers, something that comes like a virus and infects your loved one and comes home with you. And it sounds so crazy. And I have not had that experience at all, but that might be one of the main reasons why Robert Bigelow sold the ranch.
This is like the Dark Mirror version of Harry and the Hendersons.
At one point in the film, you say, it seems almost half jokingly, you say that you're impervious to evil in reference to this whole thing. Can you elaborate on that? What you meant there, or what was going on there?
Yeah,
or how you feel about this whole phenomenon?
Yeah, that's my joke. Because so that was, I was chilling with Robbie. So this guy, Robbie Williams, is in the movie. He's a singer, songwriter, artist, musician, awesome dude. You know, he's just got like a cameo in the movie because he's friends with some of us on the team. And, you know, what a good guy, man. So I was kind of standing around, fucking around, talking with Robbie, making a joke, you know, because he always fucks with me, so I fuck with him. He goes, so, you know, is it scary? What are you feeling? I'm like, I'm impervious to evil. You know, that was the throwaway joke.
Yeah.
But what's behind that is kind of, I am the joke. You know, I was taken out there to be used as bait. You know, George Knapp was first the bait,
right.
And then he loved making me the bait. And of course, like, is the story of my life, when I go inside to get the night vision so I can show everybody maybe they can see a UFO, they all scream and see something when my back is turned. That is the story of my life. I am, George Knapp says he's kryptonite to the phenomenon. I feel the same way. I'm that guy. I'm that joke. So I must be impervious to evil. I've had no negative stuff. However, the people around me, they have seen on our last trip with Robbie to the ranch. You know, we brought with some of us a couple badass military, intense individuals, right? And one in particular, a security guy, he, soft-spoken, stoic, he saw, and I believe him because he barely talks, you know, he's just real chill. He saw this thing follow me, this shadow creature, humanoid, inches from my body, through the command center of the old NIDS trailer, through the light into the other room, for a durational period, this smoky, kind of textured humanoid being. He thought it was our other buddy who's 6 foot something, but he had left hours ago. I can't deny, we got off the ranch. He didn't tell me at that second. As soon as we park, he's like, he stopped the car. He told me the story.
Whoa.
But that's the story of my life. This thing's right behind me. I don't see it. Maybe right. I dodged a bullet, but I must be impervious to evil.
And
that's
what did he
joke.
Describe seeing behind you?
So what he didn't know was that it's something that has been described in that little command center on multiple occasions, but those are, they used to be classified files. He had no idea that that's something that appeared there. But what he saw was what they call a sentient mist. It is a humanoid, structured, real thick, billowing black smoke appearing to the visual eye. It doesn't matter if you're coming from the shadow into the light, which I was when I was walking, and it was right behind me, following like a hitchhiker.
And is it in human form?
Yeah, it was. He said it was like a human shape. Yeah,
wow.
Human shape. And again, you know, look, this is so outside of my comfort zone. I don't know about any of
this. In the middle of our comfort zone.
Okay, you guys.
I mean, oh my God.
I'm so cozy on this couch right now. All I'm trying to figure out is how to go get that second cup of coffee so I can just...
How much does that mess with me, Mike? Because you always be like, you know, when we talk about like ghosts and entities or demons, I'm always like, yeah. But like with aliens, like, oh, aliens. And, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, they're great. And like, but now it's like you've meshed the worlds together, making it all more befuddling and linking the two together inescapably, and it just, you know, it makes one, you know, ask even more bigger questions, like, you know, just for example, like, I mean, you know, some part of the of this field, you know, relates these stories to angelic or demonic. Did you ever get that sense that there was some sort of terms are so relative, but but is there did you ever get a sense that it might have something to do with those type of polarities?
You know, it's so funny. So again, I just want to say I'm very uncomfortable talking about all this. I mean, I do have my pants off in the studio. I just
he keeps using his clothes.
Yeah,
as
let me show you this trick. Yeah, okay,
right.
Strip show. Okay, so what's interesting about what you're saying, that it really kind of shocked me. It was a very funny moment. I think I can say it. So Dr. Colm Kelleher is co-author on the book with George, and he's a scientist that was the head of the investigations at Skinwalker Ranch.
And interviewed in a lot of the footage that George had from the 90s that's in the film.
Absolutely. You get to hear directly from Dr. Kelleher, which is huge.
He's the one that tells the story of the giant wolf that approached the Gorman family on their first day.
Yeah, and he's not just some, like, you know, UFO guy. He was just, he's a scientist, a biochemist who signed up to the NIDS to be part of this exclusive, you know, science team, having probably no idea what he was getting into.
He answered an ad.
You guys keep saying.
Answered an ad in a paper.
We keep referencing NIDS. What does NIDS stand
for? Okay, so I want to get back to your question.
Yes.
So don't let me forget that.
No.
It's a weird one. So NIDS, National Institute of Discovery Science, was a scientific organization fully funded and created by Robert Bigelow of Bigelow Aerospace. You know Robert Bigelow. He has three orbiting space satellites to his name, or space habitats. He's got one on the International Space Station that's an inflatable, big-time name in aerospace and human spaceflight exploration and human habitation, Mars and the Moon. So that's NIDS.
And our listeners know him as the guy, that rich guy who doesn't use email.
Right, right.
Correct. So there are some surprises in my movie that I think people will really enjoy seeing that are unexpected. So that's all I'm going to say about that. But you get to hear from a lot of great people in this film for the first time sometimes. So that's what NIDS is. But again, there was a larger government study that happened after the NIDS study that was Defense Intelligence Agency, the intelligence agency or intelligence branch of the Pentagon. That's AWSAP, Advanced Aerospace Systems or Weapon System Application
and
Program.
And that's why there were things like command centers on this old
ranch. Well, I mean, I'm sorry, that's a bad term. We're talking about a double wide that's really nice.
Okay, right? I was picturing G.I. Joe's pit battle station.
Right, right. No, look, it's a ranch. It's a command center for what they were doing. But yeah, lots of scientific activity and everything they did, trying to communicate with the phenomenon, actually, at first, not super technically, but through games. I mean, they were doing all sorts of stuff to try to engage the phenomenon and then provoke it. And they were taking their cues from, we'll call him Tom Gorman, because he was the rancher who ended up telling them how to approach, how he was successful, kind of surprising the phenomenon, catching it in the action at times, right? So back to your question.
Yes.
Angels, demons, good and evil. Okay. Funniest thing, man. I started talking with some of the scientists directly about that. Like, man, what's described? I mean, it really starts to sound demonic. I mean, the way these things attach to people sounds like poltergeist, like exorcist. Like, this is outside my comfort zone, man. If it's not like a flying saucer is made of, like, metal that I can look at, you know, this is crazy to me when I was first getting into it.
Right.
And they're like, no. It's not like demons or something. Like, let me explain, you know, from a scientific standpoint. And they start explaining it. And as they fucking explain it, it starts sounding more and more like fucking demons. And I'm like,
You're not helping the case.
No, so I'm like looking at him like, okay, so dimensional portholes where evil's coming through? I mean, so the point is no one really knows. And the phenomenon seemed to distinguish between human beings and animals. I mean, animals.
They get the worst of it.
Oh, violence.
Yeah.
The terror and the psychological aspect, very real physical effects.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some things that have occurred that we may attribute to biological harm from the phenomenon. But I always say no real major human injuries happen because it's unprovable.
It's an interesting fact of the case, almost like it's off limits to physically harm. You know, I mean, I know in your documentary there's a native woman who might say to the contrary, but I've always found that fascinating too. Like, maybe there's some sort of rule structure in place for whatever this intelligence or entity is working with.
It almost seems accidental when an injury occurs. So the case that you're kind of talking about now is Janice, is a woman who lives in the Uinta Basin, a good friend of mine. Talked with her yesterday. Yeah, she. What was tragic for me about that interview? We had been talking for 10 months every Saturday for like an hour. Just she'd give me the gossip of the Uinta Basin and, you know,
yeah,
always jovial and really had this cool connection to the phenomenon when she would experience things. But the second I pushed record, my first time physically meeting her in an interview, she shattered into a million pieces, man.
Yeah.
It was like this weight and I started to realize the human effects go far beyond the physical of the way the phenomenon engages people in the Uinta Basin. She now has doubts about her son's illness that he has, that it was caused by that light that hit him. Mm-hmm. Her friend died from what was obviously a rare...
Well, so wait, it's for our listeners, what happened, without giving too much away, what happened to... What's the incident that happened?
Sorry, yeah. No, and there's you can say, talk about it all. I can say anything from the movie. It's never going to... You have to watch it.
That's yeah.
The whole, so we can talk about anything. But sorry, I jumped ahead. Yeah, so there's been multiple events on and around the ranch where a massive, what we would call like a mothership, some sort of craft is above, and it shines these bright lights down. Usually it appears as if they're doing something with cattle, but then they'll go out and look for their cattle, the ranchers, and sometimes that's when it happens. And this beam hit one particular rancher, and he jumped into the water and tried to splash cool his face, and he was so burned, and he got a very rare cancer and died shortly after, and that happened to multiple people. And then this friend of mine, Janice, she was hit with one of those beams with her kid when they're looking for their cattle when there was a what they call a light show happening. Now, they didn't have a dramatic burn or an effect like that, but then he did come down with – or he was diagnosed with MS, first one in any generation in his family. And there's always that doubt of did that – is that related to
yeah.
– and it's almost like it doesn't matter. It's just that that seed of doubt is real.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some real – in my film, you do – tragically, you do see kind of how the phenomenon appears to people, how they can be might have been harmed by it. And it's sad. It's
it
really
seems like a real fucking drag for a lot of people. I mean, yeah.
But isn't that what we've discovered over doing this show? Is so many of these people who have witnessed these things up close and personal, their lives are inexplicably changed thereafter, and it's usually not for the best, not for the benefit of them. You know. This is something that, you know, these type of witnesses or abductees, if you would call them, shy away from. They're not like excited to talk about it. They don't want to be in this club. You know, it's not something that they can benefit from culturally or monetarily. This is just something that, out of the blue seems to have come and affect their life. And it, you know, and it changes their world paradigm. It changes their view of reality. And it really flips their whole lives upside down.
Yeah, they're not giving us the cure for cancer. They're not giving us a technology that feeds the world. I mean, whoever these entities, these intelligence are, these visitors, you know, it's not purely benevolent. We're going real dark here, and I get it, because that's Skinwalker Ranch. And look, it's true. But there are two sides of the coin. There are people that say they have very beneficial and good experiences.
Absolutely.
Maybe even receive some sort of, you know, new ability because of their connection to seeing a flying saucer. Like Uri Geller very famously says that he had some of his remote viewing capabilities that were studied at SRI, Stanford Research Institute, by people like Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Sixth Man to Walk on the Moon, who, by the way, it was the last video interview ever before he passed away.
Which was amazing, by
so
the way.
So can't wait to get that out.
Check out Jeremy's website, extraordinarybeliefs.com, where you're going to be able to see the majority of his work, not just some of his short films that feature Dr. Edgar Mitchell and John Lear, but trailers to the films that he's working on and a little bit of insight about who Jeremy is and the type of work that he does, you know.
Thank you. And I guess just the point is just that we're all putting on this that it's scary or bad or positive and good. And I don't know the answer to that. Only people that have had these experiences do.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Skinwalker Ranch, and I'm sure some of our listeners are like, wait, wolves, dire wolves and werewolves and UFOs and portals and wait, what?
Paranormal Disneyland.
It is so weird. And it almost feels as if this area is almost designed to drive the person insane or the experiencer insane. You know what I mean? In a way, not that that's happened, but it is so baffling. One of my favorite stories from the film was stuff that had been happening before the Gormans moved there. Is in the, I believe in the 60s and 70s, there was a science, local science teacher. I can't remember his name.
Hicks.
Who got together with another individual, and they started collecting all of the eyewitness reports.
Salisbury and Hicks.
From Roosevelt and what was the other town nearby?
Vernal,
right. And so I love that there was a guy, even like an amateur researcher, Was he a high school or a local
science teacher? Yeah,
yeah. Going around and collecting eyewitness reports of UFOs or strange encounters. So this stuff has really been going on in this territory for a long time. And what I feel like your movie does really well is sort of show, and it's a little sad because it does feel like this is an area of the country that feels economically depressed. But they've been living with this very strong, wild folklore for so long that a lot of them, they are just kind of used to it. Is that fair to say?
It's actually incredible. Yet I wouldn't even say folklore. They're living.
Well, right.
I mean, because but it is part of their folklore to try to explain it. But they are living in an immersively altered reality. That,
right.
You know, it is not. Our consensus reality does not apply to the Uinta Basin. The high strangeness there is real. There's not a single person that I met that didn't have a direct experience with it or knew somebody that did. And you're right. That, you know, the science teacher you're talking about with that writer Salisbury who did the book on it, the Uinta UFO display or something like that.
That book looked awesome, by the way.
We want that.
I got to get a copy of that.
Utah UFO display, I think. Yeah,
he hand-drew, wrote down all the different individual UFOs and flying saucers that people saw around there.
Yeah. Right, and that's just the flying saucers. But remember, it is a cornucopia of high strangeness. I mean, it is so hard to wrap your mind around. You know, you want to – I have a repulsion to it. Like, I don't want to believe it, but I can't step away that's what people are reporting. So everything from flying saucers to cat mutilations to creatures and beings.
You know, Jeremy, in your film, you work on this giant chalkboard and, you know, kind of putting together your notes. You know, in the beginning of the film, I saw one of the words on the chalkboard was Masonic.
Was that just set dressing? Because I thought maybe that was just fun set dressing, but Bryce saw it as a clue.
No, I mean, I'm sure those were your notes. I mean, I'm not answering for you.
That's my actual workspace. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. You have, by the way, the coolest office.
I was like, for sure they had an art director coming in to write all this because it looks cool.
I figured out this magic concoction. If I could figure out how to sell this, okay, I get magnetic paint and I paint an entire wall.
It's cool.
Then I do chalkboard over that. Yeah. And then you can do like neodymium magnets and chalkboard. It's fucking great.
I mean, he's like the ultimate like investigator. He's got like ties going to this, pictures here. But I had to ask, I mean, you know, you don't kind of follow up on that in the film, but is there, in your opinion, is there any type of Masonic or esoteric relatings to this phenomenon?
Well, why that was on the chalkboard, because it is part of the history of what happened in the area. From what I understand, the Buffalo soldiers came through, Black Masons, right? And they stopped there for a while. And there is a carving on a stone at the ranch. Right. And it appears to look like the Masonic Square.
Wow.
Right. And so it's in high debate if that actually is. Mm-hmm. And if it was carved by the Buffalo soldiers. And it was just kind of an interesting aspect to the history of that place.
Gotcha.
Do I think the phenomenon cares about what we create as far as thought process, religion, or theology? I think no. I don't think they care.
Right.
I think it's been here a lot longer than us, and it may actually not be from somewhere else. The phenomenon itself might be the local resident of Earth, and we are passing through genetically. So,
are you familiar with the Bell Witch story from Tennessee?
Someone keeps bringing it up.
You should check that out, because they're watching the film last night. It brought up a lot of the Bell Witch for me. Now, the Bell Witch was nicknamed the Bell Witch and named after one of this. Again, it was a family of farmers. It was in this old land that I believe at one point had belonged to the, you know, as everything in this country belonged to the native tribes. And there was a cave nearby that sounds a lot like the Dark Canyon in Skinwalker Ranch. And this being that exhibited high intelligence, spoke verbally to the family, and really had it out, attached itself, I'll say herself, because it appeared vocally as a female, to the head of the family. It really seems that this was a spirit that had been in that land long, long, long before anybody had settled there. And some guy came along and built a farm. And she's like, oh, really? You think, or it, I don't want to say he, she, I'm sure it's beyond gender, was like, okay, cool. And eventually managed to kill the patriarch of the family. It's a fascinating story and a lot of parallels to what's going on in the film. The other author that I wondered if you were familiar with her work was Linda S. Godfrey. She's done a lot of stuff. She was the original person to break the story about the Beast of Bray Road in Wisconsin, which was also really going on in the 90s, and the shadowy bipedal dog man comes up a lot in her stories in Wisconsin, along with weird mists and UFO and portal activity. So there is this stuff that seems highly condensed activity in this area of Utah, but there are other pockets of it across America.
Yeah,
and there seems to be something going on around Wisconsin and Michigan as well.
Yeah, our government has identified specific hot spots. That's, you know, part of the program that was, you know, set forward with the $22 million through Harry Reid because of Skinwalker Ranch. OSAP identified other locations. That's why Bob Bigelow allowed George Knapp to write a book, was to try to identify more locations. This is not an isolated... Actually, the scientists have kind of come to the conclusion that if you studied almost anywhere with the intensity with which they studied Skinwalker Ranch, that you might have a similar level of events. I don't know. That sounds wild to me, but that was...
There were some characteristics to the ranch. I know in Linda Godfrey's work, she always talks about that in every investigation that she had where there were these... and there were animal mutilations on some of these ranches she went to in Wisconsin as well. And we haven't even really touched on the animal mutilation stuff. It's sad. It's really sad. And also the thing I think the film does a really good job is also drive home the economic hit that cattle mutilations have when you are a rancher trying to make your living off of livestock. But the one thing she seemed to point out was that wherever this activity happens, there always seems to be a body of water running through that area. And there is a river or a broad creek going through Skinwalker Ranch as well, isn't there?
Yeah. You know, it's like one of those things. I've heard that before. And it might be right. I can't make rhyme or reason of it. I don't know if locationally is even important. You know, we know that the UFO phenomenon is homogenous. We know that it doesn't matter the country, the nationality, the belief system. There's a little bit of a tendency for there to be in semi-rural areas. If you look, there's a great book, I forget the name, but it shows you every, you know, it's a huge catalog of just events, right? Mm-hmm. And you start to see this trend towards semi-rural areas. And that's probably because in the city, we're looking at buildings and in the middle of nowhere, there is nobody to see. So maybe that's why semi-rural, you really see this. Because I know when I'm in Pie Town and looking up, all I see is sky. I mean, so I'm looking, right? I know the cosmos when I'm living out there. So also Wednesdays are a big day for UFO sightings.
You know,
really? Yeah. We come out on Wednesdays.
Yeah, there you go.
Nice.
I'll follow up with that. What do you think is with the this 3 a.m. window that seems to show up in almost a lot of these cases? And even in your film, when you talk about when that shadow entity, you said, well, it was right around 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Didn't even think about that yet.
It's when all the high strangeness stuff happens. Yeah. I've had encounters at almost 4 a.m. on the dot.
Yeah.
It's something, and then even
3:33.
Yeah, 3:33. Your film ends with that too. What is the significance behind that sort of window of opportunity, perhaps for this entity or intelligence?
No idea.
Yeah, something worth exploring.
I
That's an honest answer.
People write to me all the time with, like, you know, there's number ideas, and people know a lot more than I do about that. I don't know, man. All I know is that, you know, look, the seeker's the finder. If you want to find out anything, you got to start asking questions. So if that's your interest, that's where you got to go.
Well,
I don't know
the
answer.
Well, I think in terms of, I might be wrong here, but I think in terms of where that some of that belief comes from, why that might be a window, is that it is the exact midpoint between midnight, the darkest time, you know, or let's say the middle of the night, and dawn. And in that midpoint, I think in some of folklore, they talk about that being a time period.
Almost like an equinox of microcosm.
Right, when the veil between the world of the dream world, the other world, the parallel universes, and our reality is thinnest and things cross through.
That's my best guess. You know, to throw down any kind of idea, my best guess
I'm giving myself goosebumps.
Yeah, I see him because you're not wearing pants either. Wow, man. So, yeah, I don't know. The way I like to describe it, because I don't know and I don't understand, is that there appears to be a perforated reality. And we're on one side of it. And from time and time, whatever's on the other side decides to poke through. And that could appear to us like the optical nature of a wormhole and some sort of porthole that opens up and a creature crawls through and elbows out, drops to the ground, walks away. Or craft coming through a rip in the sky. Or a ball of light, which is the most common UFO scene. It's just ball of light. So I think all of these events seem to be some sort of perforation of where we are and where somebody else exists, and it might be there. And that's why all of these things, they might be connected. They appear, in fact, to be connected. I would like it to be as simple as UFOs and beings from other star systems, however they're getting here.
Right.
But it just seems like it's more than that.
There's some sort of temporal thing happening, too. Space-time, one of the things that we talked at length about this last night.
You should have heard
the
conversation we had after this movie. And I hope all the people who need to go out and rent this and buy this, one of the best things about getting this movie is the conversation you will have with your friends afterwards. I was like, it was ultimate. It was like meta.
Well, I love the stuff you guys talked about. The Gorman family, the original rancher and his wife, they would experience objects being displaced in the blink of an eye. You know, turn your back, suddenly the things she was cooking with were in the microwave, or tools would turn out missing and show up on the other side of the house or up in a tree. And one of the details I think was that there was a fence that had been relocated almost 6 inches to the left or right of its original installation.
Well, it was a whole cord of wood. The kid went out and, you know, moved everything over. And if you've ever done that, I mean, I live off of wood burning in Pioneer Town. And man, you move a whole cord of wood yourself.
That's a lot.
And then it gets moved back instantaneously. You're pissed, man.
Yeah,
it's that kind of thing.
And I wonder if it's not an entity behind it, but some sort of space-time hiccup where objects are being moved over here or popping in and out because of some sort of, maybe it's a gravitational wave fuck up. Who knows?
But then
to the eyewitness, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, to the eyewitness, they go, oh, some sort of trickster spirit must have done this because it moved. And maybe it is some sort of flux in the space-time.
But that discludes
continuum.
The intelligence of this entity that people are talking about. And it also discludes this shadowy figure.
Well,
what if both are right, though? So that's an interesting thing. That's like the idea of a UFO and seeing it. That's the problem, is that you do have these things that could be easily described by that it's some sort of like time just went back, but then you have all these other, you know, again, precognitive intelligence that'll hide your bulls and put them in a catatonic state and then magnetize all the bars around it for no particular reason.
Right.
Crazy shit.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
But maybe that gravitational pothole that exists across that land also allows UFOs to slip in, demonic forces to slip in.
Right. Yeah. It is a highway. Whatever it is, this is some sort of nexus or
center. In Star Wars terms, this seems to be one of the hyperspace lanes that passes through. Before we move on and before we wrap up, which unfortunately we're going to have to do soon, will you please tell the story of, you mentioned a second ago, of the Bigfoot entity and the portal?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories because it really exemplifies the high strangeness of Skinwalker Ranch. You, for the first time, have these two scientists on camera actually telling you about these experiences. And I think it's been admitted somewhere that they may have been the ones involved in that.
Right.
So they're talking about scientists witnessing this, though, in the film. So they have Russian night vision at the time. It's before, you know, I've got great night vision now, but at the time that was the top quality. They see this kind of yellow glowing light down on the road. They're up on a mountain observing the ranch. The ranch is really cool. They use dogs as biosensors. They built these observation, kind of stations with dog runs and all this cool stuff. It's very cinematic. It's beautiful. But they were up on a cliff, and they see this light. And this light is just kind of gently glowing, which I have seen that kind of thing at Skinwalker Ranch. Again, I don't know what it is. There's no artificial light where I saw it. That's the only thing that I can say. I saw lights come up, but I don't know what it was.
It's a Bigfoot portal, Jeremy.
Right. If I had night vision, maybe I could have seen it. But anyway, so they're chilling, you know, late at night. They're watching two scientists, very rationally minded people, a physicist and another scientist. And they're basically looking, and one's got night vision. They see this glow. What is that? They bring up the night vision. The one holding the night vision sees an orange porthole inverted with geometry inside, digging, going deep down. It's about 4 feet off the ground. And they see a creature crawling up through, elbowing up through this geometric inverted orange glowing porthole that you could see perfectly through the night
vision.
So
it's almost like you're seeing a pipe.
Yeah, like a pipe that goes down, but it had a weird geometry in it.
Wow.
And then this creature, which mainly, I'd say it's kind of a void of light was how it's described, because if you understand, you know, night vision technology, so you're looking at a spectrum of the light the eye doesn't really see. So you're seeing this in HD, basically. And this creature, they thought maybe weighed about 700 pounds, big-ass creature, 8 feet tall, uses his elbows, pushes out through this porthole, drops down onto the ground.
Pulls itself.
Yeah, like elbows. Like
pushes. Like, yeah. Holds a so thin air sci-fi. Portal and
think
pulls
of a cartoon,
out.
Man. Yeah. That's what we're talking right. about.
It's like, you know, Bugs Bunny.
It's crazy. And, you know, drops down and then goes off into the forest, kind of runs off into the forest. And, you know, imagine you're a scientist put onto this ranch. You're thinking, we're going to debunk the shit out of this.
Right.
And then you fucking see a dimensional porthole with a Bigfoot void of light, dark being with no neck jumping out of this, elbowing out of a porthole, the porthole closing up, and it running off into the woods, and you're supposed to go back down. I mean, shit.
Like I quit.
Shit. Yeah. What? Like what? You know, they're like, oh, there's got to be hallucinogenic plants everywhere around here. We're going to study that. So they look for every kind of thing they could to describe this. Now, this porthole thing, this is described all over the Uinta Basin, but particularly at the ranch. And very interestingly enough, the Gormans, when they would have this thing on a regular basis crack open in the sky, it would be this like slit in the sky, out would come craft, like UFOs. So it's not just like beings coming out, but also craft coming through. And then the cool thing about it is optically, depending on the angle in which you looked at it, you wouldn't see it. Now, this is one of the reasons why the Defense Intelligence Agency was interested. Imagine, from a warfare perspective,
of course,
if you could insert warriors, insert craft. So one,
you
they're
could tear
afraid,
open the sky.
Yeah. So one, they're afraid. You know, who are these craft? You know, where are they from? What do they want? Why are they bringing craft over here? Who are these beings? But also, if you flip it, that's a technology. If it's a technology that we're just, it seems like magic, we want.
Right.
So that was one of the reasons why it was taken so seriously by our United States government studied the paranormal, period. $22 million. Deal with it.
Yeah. Amen.
Where is the footage of that? Where is the footage of these portals opening?
So this is the sickening part of it, and you're just going to have to accept it or not. The best that I can say, and I had a long talk with George Knapp about this the other night, and Dr. Kelleher, we have to accept that this it is an intelligence, that's for sure. It is an intelligence with knowledge of technology.
And of our technology.
Yeah, absolutely. It seemed to know where the cameras were pointed and it would perform somewhere else. It was always doing that, you know, making you chase it thing. So we just have to accept it is aware of our technology and it does not want to be caught on camera and it does not want to have that kind of scrutiny. And in fact, it started receding and going away the more that the scientists brought more equipment onto the ranch. Hmm. The rancher originally said to them, you need to hunt this like a sentient creature, like a wild animal. And the louder you are and the more you're coming at it with all these gadgets, the less you're going to encounter it. And he was damn right.
Amazing.
And Bigelow eventually sold the property in 2016, which I did not know until watching the film. I had assumed he still owned it.
And the new owner is in my film.
Is
amazing.
Not named, but yeah. I have a theory.
Michael had a couple guesses last
night. Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah. I
think it's I will Tom not Blanc. Confirm or deny even with my eyes.
I think it's Blink 182. But so, maybe I'm...
Well, I will tell you actually, no.
Okay.
It's not.
All right, cool.
It's not. It's
off
not Tom. Can't,
off right. Mike, will you tell me if we don't report
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I love the theory. Here's the point, and you see in the movie, the first thing I ask the new owner of the ranch, which, by the way, gave us access, allowed me to film current day on the ranch, also allowed me, did an interview with me. It was astounding. I'm super lucky.
Yeah.
But the one thing I ask him, first thing I say is, you know, why do you keep your identity secret? And he corrected me, and he says, I'm keeping my identity confidential, you know, both to preserve the scientific studies we're doing now from the wrong type of scrutiny, but also because I have a vast business empire that, you know, these worlds don't necessarily mesh.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure when Bob Bigelow goes in to get NASA contracts.
Bob's cool with colliding them, yeah.
Well, he's great. He has balls, man.
Yeah, he does.
Big ass balls.
He really does.
Goes on 60 Minutes and just tells everybody.
Aliens are here.
They're here.
They're right under our nose.
Us, right. Yeah. So he does, but I don't think he loves it that when he does big NASA contracts that, you know, that could be put brought up to him. He's trying to focus on that now, I'm pretty sure, but right. I don't know.
All right, so it's Elon Musk. Okay, anyway, any last questions for Jeremy before we go, or any final thoughts you guys want to share about the film?
Yeah, I just, and you guys had a great spread in Shadows of Your Mind magazine, the July-August issue, and in it they interview you about the film and George Knapp, and one of the lines that George laid out that I think is great is, he says, "Eventually I came to understand a very uncomfortable idea, the idea that another intelligence lives here. It's not an intruder from somewhere else, not a traveler just passing through. I think people will have trouble getting their heads around the idea that we humans are living in someone else's world, not the other way around." And that had a real ring of truth to me.
Yeah, man. George Knapp has clarity. Yeah. I mean, that guy has seen it all. I mean, he's done stories on the mob, on religion, he's however 27, 37 Emmys,
yeah.
Peabodys.
Yeah.
The guy's incredible. An incredible reporter. His clarity on this, I mean, yeah, when he talks, I listen, man. He's got some real wisdom on this stuff.
Well, you bring incredible clarity to these types of high strangeness as well, Jeremy. We are so lucky to have you as a guest and so honored. And for those of us, for those of you guys out there listening, I want to say, order this film. Buy this film,
yes,
on iTunes. And not only that, do us a huge up, rate it, review it. And let's put this thing at the number one slot in docs, because, I mean, it's a game-changing documentary. And believe me, documentaries are my steez. This one is at the top of my list. So
yeah.
Congratulations. And thanks, we're so lucky, man, to have you on your release date. It releases today, September 11th. So
where can people get it? Bryce mentioned iTunes.
So on all pay-per-view platforms. So iTunes is great because you get over an hour and a half, about an hour and a half of bonus material. And also on Vimeo, you get the hour and a half of bonus material. But all pay-per-view platforms and pretty much globally. So yeah, thank you for that. That does help me be able to make the next one, because there's a lot still to tell on this story.
Can you tell us what's coming up next for you?
Sure. Yeah. My next film, on an impossible schedule, another 30-year story, and the one I've always wanted to do since I was 13 years old, is the Bob Lazar story.
Oh, wow. It's come full circle.
That's right. December 3rd in L.A., actually. So check this out. I haven't told anybody because it just got confirmed this morning.
Oh, fantastic.
So, on December 3rd in L.A. at the Ace Hotel Theater. If you guys know that spot,
it's
the Charlie
Chaplin spot.
Oh my gosh, beautiful. My dream theater.
Totally.
My dream has come true. I am going to premiere my movie there on December 3rd.
Oh.
The Bob Lazar movie, hosted with me and Bob.
Oh.
And it's open to the public to get a ticket. It's going to be $20 for everybody.
We'll be there.
$20.
We're there.
Yeah.
We're there.
And so,
do we get a press pass?
So listen, please come, because I'm putting my neck on the line here. I rented that theater. I need to fill that theater, or I'm screwed. So, but I'm doing it because I know what it's like. I want to see this movie myself, and Bob will host it with me. What a night to remember. So December 3rd at the Ace Hotel Theater, big night, guys.
When the time comes closer, we'll be sure to double back on that to make sure that theater gets packed. And I'm sure you will have no problem with the value of your work that you're doing filling that theater.
Absolutely.
Patient 17, your first film, where can we find that?
Netflix is usually the easiest for people, but it is also available on all those other platforms
as well.
Yeah, thanks so much, guys. And yeah, as we get closer to the Lazar film, that is a story that I'm not trying to convince you whether it's true or not true. I no longer have the luxury of disbelief, and that's the best way I can explain it.
Yep.
Obviously, there's a lot of people I talk with that don't go on camera with me that I can't put forward. But I will say, you should hear Bob Lazar's story now in the lens of 30 years, that it might be the singular most important UFO story that has ever been told. And if he is telling the truth, if you choose to believe him, that has implications for your life. So get ready for that film, and if we get closer to it, we should spend a time just talking about that, because that's a whole nother enchilada right there.
Wow, here.
Yeah, we will definitely have you back to
discuss
that.
All right, we got to do that.
Cool. Well, what a podcast. Thanks, this was. This is a highlight for me. I'm super excited.
You're retiring now from the show?
Yeah, I don't know if they told you your press. You gave us a press screener with 4 views, and I brought it over last night. They're like, "There's only 1 view left." I'm like, "Yeah, I was on it a few times."
Like, we thought you were waiting to watch it with us. He's like, man, I was really excited about it.
So again, man, thank you so much for being here. We're lucky to have you.
And, thanks, guys.
So Jeremy, even though this wasn't a traditional Bigfoot Collectors Club episode, it was a fantastic one. Thank you so much. I have to ask you before we leave Skinwalker Ranch. We ask all our this to all of our guests when we share stories of high strangeness.
What the hell was that?
What the hell was that? What is it? What's going on? What do you think?
I think there are people better qualified to answer that than me, to be honest with you. I'm just starting to wrap my head around the testimony itself. But there appears to be an intelligence that is engaging humanity, and it has been doing it since probably before recorded human history. It comes in different forms: flying saucers, entities, creatures, sometimes just mists. Whatever it is intelligent, it is real, and it is influencing human events. And it's fucking fascinating. And that's all I know.
Great.
That'll work for me.
I think you're too modest, but great. Bryce, anything you want to plug before we go?
Nope.
Great. Me neither. Watch the
movie. I want to plug you guys. You guys, this is the coolest studio. I mean, I'm surrounded by guitars and cool dudes and coffee. Yeah, you guys should post some photos from here. You guys got a cool space.
We've got some up there, but we need to do more. We've been in the middle of a...
For Ludwig,
I guess I should say Riley's been in the middle of a bit of a studio redesign, but...
We got David Bowie autographs on the wall.
glad you like it. Amazing. We're lucky to have Riley and his studio.
Riley, anything to plug?
I just want to echo Bryce's sentiments. Like, watch this film and rate and review it, because like this really is a grassroots kind of effort that brings this information to light. And I really like what you said about weaponizing your curiosity. Like, The more that people are thinking about this and talking about this, the more it becomes normalized to discuss, and people don't just think you're crazy. And I think this film really presents it really well. And I would just really encourage you to watch it and tell people about it and push it up in the algorithm. And let's get this conversation out into the broader public.
And have one of those meta discussions after, like we did. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Watch it with your friends.
Watch it with your friends, man. Have a good time with it.
Yeah. Well, I also want to plug, Riley, your band, Spindrift, is playing this weekend.
Oh, yeah. We're playing out in your neck of the woods.
Pappy and Harriet's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let me plug that. Pappy and Harriet's. It's the center of the universe. You ain't done nothing right in your life if you haven't gone to Pappy and Harriet's, and you'll have a chance to see your band play.
Oh, dude.
Where do people get tickets? Amen.
Road trip.
I mean, just show up.
Okay, cool.
You'll be all right.
All right, cool. Yeah.
We'll treat you right in Pioneer Town.
Oh, I know.
I got to do it. Sorry, my comic book adventure van is for sale right now. And if your local comic shop doesn't have it, go to them, say, I want to order Adventure Van. It is in the previews catalog that Diamond puts out. Some comic shop owners will say it's not. It is under Golden Apple Books. So check that out. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the show. I want to thank our guest, Jeremy. Thank you once again so much for coming and joining us. This is
thank
great.
Thank you, guys, man.
I feel like this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Yes, yeah. It's a bromance. We're going to hang out.
Nice.
Awesome, man. Thanks to our listeners. We love you guys. And also make sure to check out everything we've got up on the Patreon this month. We got some exciting stuff happening. This month and every month until next week, we remain the Bigfoot Collectors Club.
See ya.
Later.
Bigfoot Collectors Club is produced by Riley Bray. Our theme song is Come Alone by Sun Eaters, courtesy of Lotus Pool Records. If you like the show, please rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps get the podcast to more listeners. To support the show, check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Bigfoot Collectors Club and unlock multiple reward episodes every month.
Hey guys, Heather Ashley here, host of the Big Mad True Crime Podcast. If you're looking for a true crime podcast with all of the details and none of the small talk, you have found your people. Each week, we dive deep into a new case and learn everything there is to know, from getting to know the victim and the impact their case has had on those around them, to the investigation into what happened to them and who is or might be responsible, and if the bad guy looks like he might drink whiskey by a dumpster or has the social skills of an ogre, we say it because we were all thinking it anyway. As the name suggests, we get big mad over true crime, and I would love to have you join our incredible community of listeners with big hearts and zero time for small talk.
Subscribe to Big Mad True Crime anywhere you listen to podcasts and listen to new episodes every single Monday.
In the 1970s, John Todd burst onto the evangelical scene with a shocking tale. He claimed to be a former witch involved in a then unheard of secret organization called the Illuminati and urged Christians to prepare for a violent world takeover.
First of all, the number one weapon in everybody's home should be a 12-gauge pump shotgun.
Hear the amazing story of one of the originators of the modern-day conspiracy theory. From Magnificent Noise and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Cover Up, the Conspiracy Tapes.